we don't script it so much as give it goals and boundaries and parameters. Like, this is what the schedule looks like. This is what's available. Your job as an AI is, in a friendly way, to schedule this patient. And that's very different from sort of the IVR type systems that we're used to in healthcare. In healthcare, that's the primary issue, is risk. So how can we create something together that's got a very low risk threshold, build some trust, show success, and then scale it up?
Hello and welcome to the Better Care Podcast, where we share the stories and insights of clinicians, healthcare leaders, and innovators who are improving the way clinicians work and deliver care. This episode was recorded at the Nashville Healthcare Sessions 2025 conference, and our guest is Dr. Edmund Jackson, CEO and co-founder of Unity AI and former chief data officer at HCA Healthcare. He joins Amy Deaton, president and COO of Evidence Care, to explore his operational approach to AI and how it can improve flow and decision-making in hospitals and across the broader healthcare ecosystem. If you're a hospital executive or industry leader looking for practical ways to take AI from pilot to production to measurable outcomes, this conversation is for you. Enjoy this episode with Amy Deaton and Dr. Edmund Jackson.
Good morning.
Morning, Amy. How are you?
Good to see you today, Edmund.
Likewise.
I'm excited to be back behind the mic hosting the Better Care Podcast. And I'm here with Edmund Jackson today, and we are at the Nashville Healthcare Council Sessions Conference here in the Music City.
Healthcare City.
That's right. Today, we're going to dive into a few different topics today, and I'm excited to get into a conversation about leadership, entrepreneurship, and of course, AI in healthcare.
Beautiful.
But before we do that today, Edmund, I want to brag on my friend here first, of course.
Thank you.
So Edmund Jackson, thrilled to have you here with me today. Edmund is the founding CEO of Unity AI and has previously led the data vertical at HCA Healthcare, holding positions like chief data officer as well as chief data scientist.
What a privilege it was.
Absolutely. And you should be so proud. Last year, Unity AI raised $4 million in seed round funding, and you are focused on healthcare operations in AI.
That's right.
Would love to double click on that in just a moment. You guys may know Edmund from his TEDx talks. He is an accomplished speaker and an expert in the field of data and
You're
AI.
Kind. Thank you, Amy.
So thrilled to get into the conversation today. So let's do that and start with Unity AI. So tell me about where you're focused on healthcare operations in AI.
Thank you, Amy. So Unity AI, we bill ourselves as the agentic workforce for healthcare. So we're really trying to figure out where are the right applications of agents in healthcare today. So what's pragmatic, what's solvable today? And we're really, really focused around scheduling right now. So both of the patient and of the staff member to create access and space on schedules.
Excellent. And you've been obsessed with this problem solving and the value that it can bring. So let's go back to the founder story, if you will. So you went from Quat Finance to data at HCA Healthcare and now founding Unity AI. What was your I have to build this moment? What was the motivation behind Unity AI?
The real moment is actually how I got into healthcare. So I'd been in finance for a long time, great career, but I found myself in Nashville in Dr. Perlin's office at the time. He was the chief medical officer for HCA Healthcare. And I was very confused because I asked him, you know, Dr. Perlin, I'm a math guy. I'm a numbers guy. What do you want me for? What could you possibly do with me in hospitals? And he told me about this disease called sepsis. And he said, the issue is we have the treatments, but we don't identify it fast enough to treat it. And so by the time we can apply therapy, it's really too late. And he, Dr. Perlin, realized at that time, which was, you know, over a decade ago, that AI, data science, data were the answer to the problem. And he convinced me of that in the office. And what he didn't realize was that sepsis had killed my father when I was a teenager. And so I was sitting there and was like, I've got to build this. There's no question about it. So that got me into healthcare. And I've never looked back. It's just the mission keeps me here. It inspires everybody around us. And it's just, I'm looking forward one day to telling my grandkids all the things that we've built and the changes that we've made to people's lives across a career. So that's what keeps me here. With Unity AI, it's a little bit more of a sort of a roundabout kind of a story. You know, I was looking at the world and I saw Gen AI happening, so sort of GPT 2.5, and like, this is going to be a big deal, but I have absolutely no idea what it means, but neither does anybody else. So why not be one of the people who figures it out?
Right.
So we've spent the last couple of years running experiments, trying to find the right place to apply generative AI, AI agents more recently in healthcare. And we really believe we found it with scheduling. So it's more been a scientific process rather than a eureka moment.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's so inspiring, your story, and to be able to pull a personal mission to tie that to the work that you're doing with AI is so important, because it, as a founder, you know, it takes grit to start a company. And I think that's a perfect segue into my next question. So what's one lesson you learned from being at HCA, working in data there, and now becoming a founder and bringing that to the world you're in today?
It's the complexity is really the thing. You know, I really love hospitals. I've spoken before about how it's where most of us both start and end our lives. It's an extremely profound place, and I really love them. But the lesson I've learned, both by having people try to sell to me while I was, you know, an executive at HCA, and subsequently trying to sell to hospitals, is that it's just really, really, really not the place to start. The and it's not malice or anything. It's just there's a metabolic and a risk difference between a mature health system and a startup as to the spaces in which you live.
Absolutely.
And creating that overlap is so very, very difficult. And so life is fun. It really uses your words against you your whole life through. And, you know, for years I told startups, don't try and sell to health systems. You won't succeed. And then what do? I found a startup and try to sell to health systems. And it goes about as well as you'd expect. So no, I'm exaggerating. It's been great. We have some really great health system partners. But it's very difficult to grow at a rate that a startup needs to grow at. And so my advice is balance it out across the different settings. Hospital systems, healthcare systems are tremendous. So much good work happens there. But you need to balance it out with smaller settings of care, which can move faster so that you can have a balanced portfolio of clients that allow your business to grow.
Yeah, I empathize with that. Just being in the world that I'm in,
no doubt. Is
definitely takes a lot of patience and perseverance and a lot of lessons learned that you need to apply. So let's move on to AI. What's hype? What's real? So where is AI already delivering dependable value inside the hospital today, in your opinion? And of course, that can change year to year as AI is evolving quickly. And then, of course, on the flip side of that, what still feels like it's in the science project phase?
Yeah, great question. You know, the trouble with AI is it moves, right? So, you know, we've used the term since the 60s, you know, for like very, very basic planning systems that are now like on everybody's watches. So it's where is AI today? Is like, where is it being applied today? It's my favorite working definition of AI is it's the next impossible thing that computers will do, because it's always slightly intangible. Some of that's like technology vendors like to create a little bit of hype. And so it's coming in 3 months. It's coming in 6 months. So a lot of it is sort of by construction, never applicable. So you've got to look like one back from that. And by the time it's applied, it's just technology. So the stuff that's just moved from hype to real, I would say definitely scribes. So the application of those has been magnificent. So, you know, physicians, nurses being able to speak their notes, speak their interaction, and have the computer write that out, fill out all of the documentation. Magnificent. It's awesome. I think that's the most tangible, most important use case of AI today in healthcare. Beyond that, obviously, rev cycle, there's just a ton going on there. I've spoken before about rev cycle. I think it's, you know, I think applying technology in rev cycle is a bit like putting racing stripes on a dump truck. It's just not going to go faster. It's broken from first principles. And so we need to like fundamentally reevaluate how we do that. I'm hoping that VBC is a path towards that. But as people smarter than me have said, that's a very difficult model. So there's more there. Computer vision, specifically in radiology, has been huge. I think there's a lot that's real there and being applied and brought to scale. So that's where I'd see a lot of stuff emerging. Remote patient monitoring, or RPM, sending patients with devices that have monitoring around them that are connected up with human workflows that then appropriately escalate or don't escalate people. I think that's a huge thing. science projects. Personalized medicine is my favorite eternal science project. We keep hearing about it. Genomics, still a science project outside of onco. Like, onco's real. A lot of the consumer things, sadly, are still not quite there. Yeah, I'm a huge quantified self person. So I wear my Oura ring and my bands and my watches and my glucose patch, even though I'm not diabetic. I love all the data, but that's fundamental to me. But, you know, it's still when I wake up and I feel crap, it says, you feel crap. I'm like, yeah, thanks.
What do I do now, right?
Yeah, I would go back to bed. I can't, you know? So there's still a lot of science there. So yeah, that's kind of where I'd say it is. You know?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think in terms of people, process, and technology, I think sometimes there's this false expectation or unrealistic expectation that if you just put the tech in, just AI is going to fix it all.
Right.
But you can't really put lipstick on a pig or a bad process, right?
So right, Amy. So right.
So going back to the racing stripes and kind of where AI is. So I've heard you say in previous talks that AI can look like an intern level work, right? But it's improving fast, evolving quickly. What's crossed the line for you this year that you have seen that has kind of moved from that intern to higher value?
Yeah. So I think I said AI is intern level work about a year ago, maybe 18 months ago. And that it would get to a PhD level in 2 to 3 years. And I still stand by that. It's now, I would say it's grad student level. So the real thing that crossed that line this year were the deep research and the reasoning models. So Gemini deep research, OpenAI's deep research, Claude's deep research, where you ask it a question and you say, go research and come back to me in 10, 15 minutes. Being able to assemble all of that material and then reason over it specifically and create reports, that's really graduate student type of work. Still not 100%. Humans are not 100% either, but it's a significant improvement from the intern level work that we were seeing as little as 12 months ago. So the advent of reasoning models has been a huge step forwards. The other one in the last year, which changed the course of our business, was the advent of voices that are human-like combined with that reasoning. So one of the other ways I think about AI is it's those aspects of humanity or a human or a person that a computer can now do. So things like seeing, speaking, listening, smelling, tasting, talking, those human attributes that separate us from dogs and cats. As computers do that, I view that as AI. So computers that can have a conversation that feels natural is very much an exhibit of AI. Not the right word, exhibit, but whatever. It's AI. And only over the last 12 months have the voices been good enough and the reasoning behind those voices be good enough to carry a conversation.
It's fascinating.
It's extraordinary. So, you know, we, as I said, our voices call patients to schedule them. And patients will go off on all kinds of tangents. And it doesn't trip the AI up. You know, we've had cases where someone's like, hold on a second, I need to go and, you know, get my laundry. And the AI was like, I'll wait. And it can understand that intent, hold the conversation, move it forward. That naturalness is very, very new and exciting.
Yeah, tell me more about that in your world and what you're doing with scheduling. Like, how does that, like, how has the response been to this evolution?
So good. We were a little worried that, so what we do is we make an AI and it calls you and it says, hey, Amy, you saw your orthopedic surgeon yesterday. She's ordered an MRI of your knee. I'm calling from the radiology clinic. Can I get you in this week? No. How about next week? 9 o'clock? I'll get you at, you know, Sunny Hills. Oh, you can't make Sunny Hills? How about like Misty Waters? Like, and it'll have that conversation and schedule you. It'll handle things like multiple schedules, etc. So it gets you on the calendar. But what's exciting about it is that we don't script it so much as give it goals and boundaries and parameters. Like, this is what the schedule looks like. This is what's available. Your job as an AI is, in a friendly way, to schedule this patient. And that's very different from sort of the IVR type systems that we're used to in healthcare. But we were still very worried when we launched it that, you know, we're going to get, you know, Mr. Grumpy is like, human, 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 give me a human. We've had very little of that. You know, less than 10% of our calls end up being escalated to a live agent to be handled.
Wow, either because someone's upset. That's impressive.
Thank you, Amy. Yeah, we work very, very hard. The team is just pulling all-nighters all the time. I'm so proud of them. We have so many details that need to be right. You know, things like how it says a phone number is something we recently worked through. So if the patient asked for the facility's number, it would spurt out 615-432-1777. It's not how we as humans say that. We want a 615-432-9881. And teaching the AI that cadence so that it's natural for the human and the patient is really, really the key of what we're detailing out every single day. And the uptake has been great. The reason is, one, that. Two, it's available. This is sort of why I'm so excited about this, is when you call the AI, it answers immediately. There's no press one for a long wait, press two for a longer wait. You call, the AI answers you immediately, knows who you are, and it can help you. And it will immediately in your language. And that is a completely different surface for access over healthcare. And we're very, very excited about that aspect of it.
Yeah, I bet. I think of my parents, like they wouldn't even know that it was an agent.
No.
You know? So I think that's fascinating.
We do advertise ourselves. So we announce ourselves, like, I'm a virtual assistant on behalf of XYZ. Because otherwise people do, and they'll have a whole conversation with it. We've had people, 45 minutes talking about
it. For sure, that would be my dad. I would love to hear what that agent sounded like when you first started compared to now, as it's gone through its learning.
Huge advances.
Yes, that's great. So you talked about your team. I want to move on to leadership for a minute here. So, you know, it's hard to prioritize. What should I be doing? What should I not be doing in your role? You have limited resources. There's a lot to attack in the healthcare space. So what decision-making rules keep you calm when the data is noisy and the runway clock is ticking? Tell me a little bit about that.
You know, we're a first principles company. We always go back to, what's the first principle here? And again, back to HCM, I was really privileged there to learn what Dr. Frist's first principle was, and we apply it. And it's, take care of the patient and everything else will follow. And so we take care of the patient and everything else follows. And so while it's like, oh, do we really need to get this phone number polished? Yes, we do. It's good for the patient. Do it. And so that's what keeps us grounded. We know that we're creating value for our clients and hence their patients. And so that allows us to focus. Like, what is the most important thing for the patient experience that we can be doing right now? And we focus on doing that. And that keeps us grounded as all of the chaos like goes on around us.
Got it. I think that's a great principle to stand by. You can't go wrong with that. In terms of governance, so you talk about, you know, patient at the center. There's a, you know, when you have AI in healthcare, in the clinical space, talking with patients, it is something that health systems, ambulatory facilities, they take very seriously, and it's new for some of them, right? I know for me, we're pioneering with some of the health systems because they may have data governance, but have never had AI governance before. And so that's a new process. What are some of your non-negotiables as it relates to AI governance and deploying your product? Think principles that you are.
Okay. First rule for us is we don't do anything clinical. Like, we stay away. It's one, I personally, I'm not sure that AI is fully ready for the clinical environment. It's just too much that's not in data, that only the people working there, the clinicians themselves, like you've been in hospitals, like you, that nurse who walks into the room and can just see there's something wrong with the patient, that doesn't exist in data anywhere. And so that risk calculation that they're able to do is just non-paralleled. So we stay away from clinical for one, that reason. Also, we're just subscale for that type of thing right now.
Yeah.
So we strictly stick into operations and clinical operations. We also are very deliberate around having humans in the loop, at least in a management loop. So
absolutely,
there's sort of a risk surface. And if there's a point at which you cross, it needs to be a human in the loop to be validating that what the AI is doing is correct. But below that threshold, it's still a case of, is the AI still performing as it was in testing? So we have continual tests on all of these calls. Is it doing the right thing? Is the experience right? And then, are we looking at that? Because there's often this temptation of, well, I built this testing harness around my piece of tech and it's good, we're done. But we're not done. It needs to go into the management process of us as the provider of the AI, and probably also the client, so that they're seeing, what's the performance of this? Is it degrading? Is it performing? So eyes on is the second principle.
And then, do you bring those clients into that human in the loop review to get their buy-in and
absolutely.
Eyes on it?
You know, so the product that we sell, it has the access for all the people for every call, recording, every transcript, every everything. We believe in complete transparency so that everybody can feel comfortable and see, and in our case hear, of course, what's going on. And that's how you have to build trust is, there you go.
Yes, it is. Trust is a big factor.
Very much.
So you've talked about things that have gone well, that you've done right, lessons learned. If you would be willing to share, what's a, we were wrong moment that maybe changed the course for you?
I think, again, it's the diversification. I was wrong. It wasn't the team. It was me. I was wrong that we could build a business just around health systems. Couldn't do it. Diversified, extended the product line into the ambulatory space. And that's been a dramatic game changer in terms of the velocity and the success that we're having. Again, it's nothing against health systems. It's just, you know, the size and scale is different, you know. We're just very, very tiny and they're very huge. And that's fine. So, very much I was wrong there. But that's the beauty of being a startup is you have this incredible feedback loop that's applied to you every single moment of every day. And you're thinking, is this right? Am I doing the right thing? Are we doing the right thing? Often that can be lost in other environments because there isn't this existential situation every month of, we only have so much time. We only have so many people. Are we doing the right thing everywhere? And that focus breeds a beautiful discipline that the entire team appreciates because it keeps us being right rather than feeling right.
Right.
There's a big difference there.
Yeah, absolutely. I always tell the team, you know, tell me why. I mean, if we don't know why we're doing something and the value that we're bringing and questioning and continuously trying to evolve, then, you know, you get stale and you may not survive.
What are we doing here?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So you talk about your team. I love that because it's not just about Edmund. No. You're a great leader, but you've got a great team behind you. What value do you praise in your team that correlates with shipping useful things to clients?
Number one is humility. We're very deliberately engineers. We build things, but we're not clinicians. We're not patients outside of when we're actually sick. And so we don't presume to know what our clients need. So you've got to approach all of this with a deep, deep respect and humility of, I have an idea. I think this is something. Tell me, is it? And then being very open and receptive to that feedback and not trying to second guess it. So there's a real information asymmetry in healthcare tech in particular. As part of the problem here is that we have these two very tall towers of like engineering excellence and clinical excellence. And there's a big different like distance between them. And as the creator of the technology, I think it's behovely on us to try and bridge that as much as possible. Clinicians have, it's not their day job. They're taking care of patients, right?
And right.
So we have to figure out, we know what's possible with technology, what's realistic, what's pragmatic, what's just fairy dust and, you know, a poster you saw in the airport. But we don't know what's the right use of that. And clinicians can tell us this, or the patient can tell us this. And so we spend so much time with our clients going deep on what should it do? How should it sound? What about this? What about that? I have this idea. What do you think about this? Try it, test it, go back. And being in that continual, very, very humble and rapid cycle of improvement. And that, as I get to the last point, be right, don't feel right.
Right, I love that.
Yeah, we feel wrong all the time and that's where we should be. It's very uncomfortable, but it makes you right over time.
Absolutely. I do believe that. It's understand the workflow, understand the problem. What are you trying to solve? Because if you don't really understand that and you don't listen, then you may have great tech, but it might not be bringing value.
It's a shiny toy.
Yeah, yes. So we talked about AI in healthcare. We talked about building a company. Now let's talk about sustaining and durability. So what did you learn from raising your seed funding and articulating value in operations versus clinical AI? And how did you talk to investors?
Yeah, that was also a really big growth moment, is understanding that the notion of clinical operations is not something that people outside of healthcare really understand. You know, you watch TV, you see ER, you see Dr. House, and it's like they're these, it's about the clinical aspect.
Sure.
People's personal experience of healthcare is the clinical aspect. You go and you see your doctor, you see your nurse, you see your whoever, and they take care of you clinically. And communicating to investors that there's this whole other world that's necessary, that became really important. So the analogy I like to use is like an F1 race team, right? You've got the driver, that's the doctor or the nurse, but they need the team of thousands of people behind them to have the car and the tires and the gasoline and all the rest of it. And that's clinical ops. You need all of that such that the clinician can produce the care at that very, very high level. So learning to communicate that was very important. It's also part of our sustainable or defendable advantage as a startup is that we come from that world. We understand it very, very deeply. I like to say we're not tech coming to healthcare. We're healthcare bringing tech to us. And that really is a very different place to be, because we can be very picky about the problems that we choose. We can build technology that we know will scale to the really complex stuff that if you're not from healthcare, you don't even know exists. So that's our bet.
Yes. I mean, I feel that too, where I have investors that, you know, they may not understand the complexity of healthcare and why doesn't it work like fintech? Well, let me count the ways for
How
you.
Long do you have?
Yes, absolutely. So where does Unity AI plug in first to show proof without boiling the ocean?
Yeah, that's really art here. Again, lessons learned over more than a decade. People think it's the quickest thing. It's not. It's the lowest risk thing. You've got to find, we spend time with our clients, understanding where is there that right balance where they can almost have something for free. So it's not financially free, but risk free. Because in healthcare, that's the primary issue is risk. So how can we work with a client and create something together that's got a very low risk threshold, build some trust, show success, and then scale it up? And it's different with every client what that looks like. The one we've had a lot of success with is referral follow-up. So often it's a case of we'll have a specialist provider of some kind, and their business comes through referrals, and they're usually unable to get to all of the referrals in a timely fashion. So we will work with them and say, okay, you work the top priority with your live agents and give us the rest. And the AI will call those patients. It's effectively free because you weren't going to get there anyway. Then the AI can take those patients on, get them scheduled. And we're showing sort of 25% increase in referral rates as a result of that. And so that's great because it's basically free. And if that isn't the case, we'll do things like referrals or reminders. Very, very low risk things, very small technical integrations. That's the other key piece that can just hang us up. So that's what we try to do. We also show up ready. We have all of the compliance pieces that open and shut. We can get through an IPsec review very quickly and painlessly because we know what that's going to look like. And so it makes it easy for the customer, both internally, the political capital doesn't have to get spent internally from our sponsors. And it just builds trust that, you know, these guys have turned up. They know what they're about.
Got it. Well, I appreciate you digging into the meaty topics that I had planned for today, but I love to finish with some fun rapid fire. You ready, Edmund?
No, I'm not.
Here we go. Okay. So I know you personally, and you have so many words of wisdom, but so if you were to gift a book to someone, what's your go-to?
I have one right here.
Ooh.
That one's it's The Wisdom of Insecurity by Alan Watts. And for decades now, that's been my most gifted book. So it's an introduction to sort of Zen Buddhism. The first book I read about Zen, then I'm like, oh, I get this. So he's a British guy and he writes about this very esoteric, sort of squishy, hard to pin down topic in a way that we can understand. And so I love it because it really changed my whole view on life. And I like to share that with people. So I hope you enjoy it.
What was your biggest takeaway from the book?
The biggest takeaway is we suffer because we try to prevent change. And that's actually kind of a key lesson for startups, is you have to be so comfortable with this rapid change. And the world changes all the time. That's like the first principle. And if we try to resist that, you can't. And so you get frustrated and stressed. In startups, the rate of change is enormous. It's always changing, like, you know, week to week, day to day. And being in that moment and being comfortable, sort of surfing it, that's one of the keys to success.
It's a bit ironic, right? Because we both work in healthcare and it's so complex. It's hard sometimes to feel like you're actually making an impact and changing, but also have to embrace that as a startup. Being a founder in a startup can be very stressful. Yes. So what's your favorite reset ritual between meetings or before a big meeting? What do you do?
I do a couple of things. Like, self-care is really important, you know, and it's something I share with my team all the time. It's no good performing at your peak once a month. You've got to perform at like 85% all the time. And so, you know, taking breaks, eating well, taking care of your body, making sure you're with your family. These are really important things. And it's very hard to balance that. The key thing I do is I run a lot. So I like to run marathons. I get up early in the morning before the sun and I go out and I run. And every day that brings me back to the center. And I find if I don't do it, every day I get a little bit further from the center and I'm less good at what I need to do. And so every day, just something, just bring me back to the center, reset, reset, reset. So that's my daily ritual, is that alone time, preferably in nature, just being chilled out and like resetting everything.
I love that. And I love that you're leading by example for your team.
I'm trying to.
You know, you work hard, but that self-care is a priority. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, can't end without something spicy here. So, what's a healthcare opinion you believe but rarely say on stage, but you're going to share here today on my podcast because we're friends?
Because we're friends. Okay, I love that. Okay, well, I shared my dump truck one, so that one's there. I really believe that's true. But honestly, I think that it isn't actually that hard in healthcare. The system, I think Michael Burcham said this to us. The system is performing as designed, and that's kind of shameful. And we're part of it. And so that's kind of shameful, and we should all be working a whole lot harder to get us to a better place.
Wow. And with that, thank you so much.
Well, thank you,
Amy. If I could drop my mic, I would for you, but I can't.
Thank you, Amy.
Thank you so much. Always a pleasure. Always insightful. And I learned so much from you. Thank you for
Likewise.
Being on the podcast today, Edmund.
Thanks, Amy.
Till next time, everyone.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Better Care Podcast. To ensure you never miss an episode, we encourage you to subscribe to the podcast on your preferred platform. Additionally, your ratings and reviews are invaluable in helping us reach a wider audience. Please consider leaving a review, and if you do, email us a screenshot at marketing@evidence.care, and we'll send you a thank you gift. For access to exclusive content and further healthcare insights created by Evidence Care, please visit evidence.care/bettercarepodcast and subscribe to our email list. We appreciate your support and look forward to connecting soon.